AI has not killed software. Welcome to this audio issue of Porter Stansberry's Complete Investor, published and copyrighted by Porter & Company, all rights reserved. Please note that this recording was generated via AI and may contain minor transcription errors and pronunciation mistakes. Throughout this issue, I may reference charts, graphs, and imagery that can only be viewed on our website at porterandcompanyresearch.com. No, software is using AI to kill its competitors. The helicopter door gunner's orders were simple. Shoot all the guys in black pajamas. Didn't matter that, from a height of just 100 feet above the rice paddies, it was easy to see the men were unarmed and wearing a common outfit for farm workers in that part of the Mekong Delta. The black pajamas are Viet Cong, the commanding officer, Colonel Ira Jim Hunt, insisted. Enemy soldiers. Once the pajama guys danced with a .50 caliber machine gun, it was kind of hard to prove otherwise, and easy to add a fresh pile of corpses toward that day's quota. It was 1969, 4 years into America's grueling involvement in the Vietnam War, and Hunt's helicopter crew knew better than to complain. Just log the body count, that's all that mattered. Vietnam was an unusual war, because it was hard to know if you were winning. There wasn't any territory to take over or take back, just a persistent communist faction, the Viet Cong, VC, from North Vietnam, trying to spread communism to their southern neighbors. America, acting as the world's policeman, waded in to beat back the VC. And U.S. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara took it upon himself to helicopter parent the military. McNamara was a teacher's pet in the Democratic administration of President Lyndon Johnson, which meant, in the words of one biographer, he was a fool. He was also a numbers guy, in the sense that, to him, numbers were all that mattered. In order to get a concrete picture of how the war was going, McNamara fixated on one particular set of numbers, body count. In his mind, as long as we killed more of their guys than they killed of ours, we were winning the war. The precise moment at which our body count surpassed the enemy's was expressed on a chart as the crossover point. Top brass went all out to get McNamara his quota. Harrowing war accounts, many of which were buried in classified Pentagon files until a few years ago, recall wholesale massacres of women, children, and old people just to inflate the all-important number. Kill anything that moves, Captain Ernest Medina instructed his men before a planned operation in 1968. That year, the official kill ratio was recorded as an unbelievable 134 dead Viet Cong per every dead American. At the end of the Vietnam War, the U.S.'s officially recorded body count stood near 3 million. In terms of scalps on our belt, America won the war hands down. In terms of our actual objective, preventing the North Vietnamese communist takeover of South Vietnam, we lost. It was mostly Robert McNamara's fault too. Forest, meat trees. Poor Robert actually got a logical fallacy named after him, the McNamara fallacy. The term was coined by social scientist Daniel Yankelevich in 1971, before the war was even officially over. It's the wrong-headed idea that any given situation can be accurately expressed by an equation, that numbers are all you need. The human factor doesn't enter into anything. Because why should it? Incidentally, this is the same fatal flaw we see in Adam Smith-style classical economics. It elegantly expresses the idea of efficient supply and demand, but it fails to account for people being plumb crazy. The Austrian School of Economics, my favorite, acknowledges that markets aren't a soulless equation and that irrational human behavior explains a lot about the way prices move. As part of his quest to quantify everything about war, McNamara decided he needed logistics tracking computers on the field in Vietnam. For that, he turned to ARPA, the Department of Defense Division who put together the earliest version of the internet, and tapped one of their top engineers, Bob Taylor. Bob, a mild-mannered nerd who was given an honorary rank of general for the duration of the assignment, was enthusiastic at first. He shipped out to Tan Son Nhiet in 1967 and installed an IBM mainframe, and in the process, became horrified by the brutality he saw. "We have no business being there," he told his former boss at ARPA. A year into the mission, Bob bowed out and went stateside, though he hung on to his little ID card that said general and used it to get into military bars. Not long after Bob went home, the McNamara fallacy tanked the entire Vietnam War. Based on body count metrics, LBJ assured America that the Viet Cong were all but vanquished and victory was near. Then, during the infamous 1968 Tet Offensive, the VC sprung a massive surprise attack on five major South Vietnamese cities, occupying portions of the capital and the American embassy in Saigon, and killing or wounding over 12,000 American and South Vietnamese soldiers. In terms of naked math, the U.S. and South Vietnamese forces won a military victory. Over the next month, they beat back the attack, topped the body count, reporting 60,000 dead communists, and recovered the cities. But the human factor wasn't so simple. Americans back home felt lied to and disillusioned, Turned out the war wasn't nearly over, as claimed. Public opinion turned swiftly against the Johnson administration and the conflict. LBJ did not seek re-election in 1968, and troops quietly withdrew from Vietnam in 1973, letting the communists take over the whole country. As for McNamara, he resigned and later took a position as president of the World Bank, where he refused to talk about his time as Secretary of Defense. He once exploded, "I don't want to see it. Take it back." When a Department of Defense study on Vietnam was brought into his office, the McNamara fallacy, though, lived on like a dormant virus, thanks to Bob Taylor, McNamara's computer guy. Graphic violence and Park. When Bob got back to the U.S., he accepted a job with Xerox, the photocopier company, and helped them launch a little think tank division called Park, Palo Alto Research Center, in a flat-roofed office park in California. Park focused on computer graphics, then a new field. And the brilliant team there, including luminaries like David Boggs, who helped create Ethernet, and David DiFrancesco, who later co-founded Pixar, invented almost everything you see on your computer screen today. From Park, not from Steve Jobs or Bill Gates, we got the computer mouse, the stylus, then called a light pen, and Alto, the very first personal computer to include icons, drop-down windows, and folders. It was a Park guy who unlocked the secret of depicting 3D objects on a computer screen, a Park guy who invented the laser printer, and the list goes on. By the mid-1970s, half of the world's top 100 computer scientists worked for Xerox. This brain trust pioneered the entire concept of the graphical user interface, GUI, the idea that you could interact with computer screens not just with words or numbers, but with pictures. But Xerox PARC torpedoed themselves with the McNamara fallacy. Following Bob Taylor's lead, PARC focused on engineering and equations, not on humans. They had no idea how to market their inventions or make them appealing, and frankly, they didn't want to. Alto, the mind-blowing PC with graphics on screen, was never sold. Only 2,000 units were ever built for internal use at Xerox. Apple founder Steve Jobs was baffled by the way Park dropped the ball. Xerox could have owned the entire computer industry, could have been the IBM of the 1990s, could have been the Microsoft of the 1990s, but they didn't. It fell to Jobs, who visited Park one day in 1979 and swiped their GUI ideas for his own work in Progress Computer, to break through the McNamara sound barrier and bring computer graphics to the masses. The popular myth is that Jobs pulled a corporate espionage coup and stole the specs, but in reality, it was pretty above board. The Park folks didn't mind sharing, because frankly, they just didn't care. Jobs' Macintosh hit markets in 1984, via a flashy Super Bowl ad and an irresistible sales campaign. And just like that, computer graphics exploded into the mainstream market. It turned out that outside the ivory tower, humans loved playing with images on computers, as evidenced by the now $34 billion GUI industry, growing at around 11% per year. Park itself remained insular and hidebound, dwindling over the years and eventually getting donated to Stanford University as a research lab. They did have one commercial home run with a laser printer, but even that almost got buried and only reached consumers thanks to the tireless efforts of Jack Goldman, Park's director of research. One by one, the best brains at Park defected, often taking their ideas with them to start new companies. The business we are recommending in this issue is one of those companies, a world-beating graphics software giant with a huge moat and an unbeatable tollbooth business model. Adobe isn't dying born at Park. That business is the $100 billion market cap design software business Adobe, NASDAQ, ADBE. And today, Wall Street has decided Adobe is the next Kodak. And that's a little ironic because I'm old enough to remember what Wall Street actually said about Eastman Kodak, KODK, in 1998, right before its long death spiral. Wall Street said buy. If you go back and look, you'll find that in October 1998, Barron's put a bullish Kodak article on its cover and predicted the stock would outperform. It didn't. It went to zero. I know, because I shorted the stock for years until it did. Today, the narrative that's driving shares of Adobe down is that artificial intelligence, AI, chatbots that make images for virtually no cost will destroy the market for Adobe's products. ADBE shares have fallen from a 52-week high of $376.16 to $270, a 37% drawdown, and now trade at roughly 10x next year's earnings. But a strange thing is happening. Instead of showing signs of stress, Adobe's business results are improving. Operating margins are up. Returns on capital are up. Free cash flow is up. Annual recurring revenue accelerated. And the company retired 6% of its shares in the last year. And, again, to date myself, I am old enough to remember the first time Adobe was supposedly going to collapse, back in 2012. Through 2011, Adobe sold software the way everyone sold software. You walked into a store, or you called a reseller, and you bought a box that contained the software on a CD. Creative Suite 5, CS5, cost roughly $2,500. You owned it. Adobe booked the revenue in one lump, and then prayed you would pay another $2,500 for the upgrade 18 months later. Half the time you didn't buy the upgrade when Adobe recommended it. You kept running the old version, or you pirated the new one. Piracy was so rampant that Adobe's own executives later admitted the majority of its Photoshop photo editing installations in some markets were stolen. It was a good business. Gross margins were near 90%, but it was a lumpy, leaky, low quality of earnings business. In 2012 and 2013, Adobe did something that looked, at the time, like corporate suicide. It killed the box. It announced that after CS6, Creative Suite was over, that there would be no CS7, and that the only way to get Photoshop, Illustrator, InDesign, and Premiere going forward was to rent them by the month through something called Creative Cloud. The reaction was fury. Customers signed petitions. Analysts downgraded the stock. And the financials, for two full years, looked like a disaster. When you stop selling $2,500 boxes and start collecting $50 a month, you blow a hole in your reported revenue and earnings while the subscriber base builds. You can see the wound in the numbers. Operating margin, which had run in the high 20% range, collapsed to 10.4% in fiscal 2013. The price-to-earnings, P/E, ratio, calculated on the depressed earnings, spiked to 101x. On paper, Adobe looked like a broken company. It was the opposite. Adobe was converting a leaky, one-time, piracy-prone box business into a recurring, high-retention, impossible-to-pirate subscription annuity. Every month that passed, more of the revenue became contracted and predictable. The wound closed. And what emerged on the other side was one of the great compounding machines of the modern market. The scoreboard from the trough to today. The subscription transition works so completely that today 96.4% of Adobe's revenue is recurring subscription revenue. The company that Wall Street thought was committing suicide in 2013 went on to 5x its revenue and nearly double its operating margin. Remember that the next time someone tells you a technology shift is going to kill Adobe, they said it last time. They were catastrophically wrong. Adobe's two businesses. Adobe now runs two businesses, and both are toll booths, not merely technology franchises. Digital media is the big one, $17.65 billion, 74% of fiscal 2025 revenue. This is Creative Cloud, Photoshop, Illustrator, Premiere, Lightroom, the Firefly generative tools, plus Document Cloud, Acrobat, and the PDF franchise. These are the tools that professional creative work is physically done in. A film editor cuts in Premiere. A magazine is laid out in InDesign. A photograph is finished in Lightroom. A contract is signed in Acrobat. The world's creative and document output flows through Adobe's pipes, and Adobe collects a toll on every user, every month. Digital experience is the second business, $5.86 billion, 25% of revenue. This is the enterprise marketing stack, the customer data platform, the analytics, the content management system that powers the websites and campaigns of most of the Fortune 500. It is stickier and less understood, and it is quietly compounding at double digits. Total Adobe annual recurring revenue, ARR, in fiscal 2025 was $25.66 billion, up from $20.1 billion just 2 years earlier. Digital media ARR alone is $19.20 billion. ARR is the purest measure of a subscription franchise because it strips out the noise of any single quarter and shows you the size of the annuity. Adobe's annuity is growing, not shrinking. But that's not the best proof. Behind the current ARR sits $22.5 billion of remaining performance obligations. RPO is money customers have signed contracts to pay Adobe, but that Adobe isn't allowed to count as revenue yet. Adobe's entire yearly revenue is about $23.8 billion. So the backlog of already signed, not yet counted money, $22.5 billion, is almost an entire year of revenue that's essentially already in the bag before the year even starts. A business about to be disrupted does not have a year of revenue locked in a drawer. The economics of Adobe's business are so good, it's almost unfair. Return on invested capital, ROIC, 35.6% return on equity, ROE, 55.4% free cash flow, FCF, $9.85 billion, a 41.4% FCF margin gross margin, 89.3% Adobe turns 41 cents of every revenue dollar into free cash, earns 36% on its invested capital, and grows its recurring revenue at double digits is, by definition, an extraordinary business. There are perhaps a dozen companies of this scale on Earth with these economics, but, will they persist? The bear case on Adobe is well known. AI models are going to destroy almost all kinds of application-specific software, if not outright then by a thousand cuts, as the price of such software will fall because agentic AI delivers these kinds of tools and applications, but I suspect this badly misjudges the real service that Adobe is providing, a service that will be remarkably difficult for AI to unseat. After all, not even Steve Jobs could destroy Adobe. What really powers Adobe? In 2010, Apple co-founder Steve Jobs sat down and wrote a death warrant. The essay was called Thoughts on Flash. It banned, forever, Adobe's Flash player from the iPhone. Flash was an animation plugin and Apple owned the operating system. So Apple flipped a switch, locked Flash out, and within a decade Flash was dead and buried. The most powerful tech platform company on earth killed an Adobe product and there was nothing Adobe could do about it. But Jobs didn't try to kill Adobe's other products, Photoshop, Illustrator, or Acrobat. And in the 15 years since, nobody, not Apple, not Google, not Microsoft, not a single AI startup, has even attempted to kill those three leading design platforms. Why? Adobe's technology lives inside virtually every creative professional's hands. Apple couldn't lock Adobe out even if it wanted to because a huge share of Photoshop and Premiere users buy Macs, and Apple needs those users to sell premium machines. Steve Jobs gutted Nokia, BlackBerry, Kodak, and Garmin. But he couldn't even touch Adobe. So when those bearish on Adobe say AI will dissolve Adobe's moat, I suspect they're completely wrong. If a company as ruthless and as dominant as Apple couldn't kill this business at the height of its power, how will AI? Can AI make a better picture? Maybe, but that's not Adobe's moat. Adobe's moat is made of five different factors. None of them is Adobe makes the best image generator. 1. The workflow. Photoshop has thousands of features refined over 35 years. A professional retoucher's hands know where every tool lives. The muscle memory, the keyboard shortcuts, the plugin ecosystem, the file format standards that every printer and agency and studio expects, that is switching cost measured not in dollars but in years of retraining. A text-to-image model does not replace that. 2. The file format. PDF is Adobe's invention and remains the legal and commercial standard for documents. PSD, AI, and INDD are the working formats of the creative industries. Owning the format means owning the interchange. Everyone has to speak Adobe to work with anyone else who speaks Adobe. 3. Distribution. Adobe told investors on its most recent call that monthly active users, MAU, of Acrobat and Express surpassed 750 million, growing 20% year over year, YI, and the MAU across Firefly, Express, and Premiere Mobile passed 70 million, up over 35%. Adobe is not waiting around to be disrupted by AI-native newcomers. It is sitting on the largest installed base of creative and document users in the world, and it is shipping AI into that base faster than any startup can acquire users. The startup has a model. Adobe has the model and 750 million users to sell it to. 4. Commercial safety is the most valuable mode of all. Adobe trained its Firefly models only on content it owns or has licensed. That means an enterprise can use Firefly output in a paid advertising campaign without fear of a copyright lawsuit. The general-purpose models trained by scraping the open internet cannot make that promise, and no large brand's legal department will approve them for commercial use until they can. Adobe turned the thing that looks like its weakness, a smaller, safer, less flashy model, into the only generative tool a Fortune 500 legal team will clear. That is why Coca-Cola, KO, IKEA, JP Morgan Chase, JPM, Nintendo, NTDA, and Sony, SONY, are named enterprise wins, not defections. Adobe has a profitable AI business. It made Firefly the front end to more than 25 partner models, Google, OpenAI, Black Forest Labs, Runway, and it charges for all of them through a generative credits meter. Adobe monetizes AI usage whether the underlying model is its own or a competitor's. Credit consumption grew roughly 3x quarter over quarter. Management now says AI-influenced ARR exceeds one-third of the entire book of business. The company that was supposedly going to be killed by AI is charging rent on its own AI. The cost of cutting out Adobe. The final and most important moat that Adobe owns is the very real cost and risk of a business owner switching a foundational software application. Adobe's full Creative Cloud Suite lists at about $80 per user per month for enterprise, and large customers negotiate that down to roughly $42 to $58 on a multi-year agreement. Call it $700 a year for a seat that gives a designer every tool Adobe makes. Nobody wants to risk disrupting their company's revenue and marketing channels to save $700 a year on a license. And price the alternative. Years of layered PSD, AI, and INDD project files either convert imperfectly or don't convert at all, so live client work breaks. Freelancers and partner agencies who send and receive Adobe files can no longer collaborate. plugins and templates the studio built over a decade stop working. And for a stretch of months, output slows and deadlines slip while the whole shop climbs a learning curve. A single blown campaign for a major client costs more than a decade of Adobe subscriptions. It isn't worth it. That is the real moat. The switching cost is large enough that no creative director will ever want to do it. Adobe has priced itself precisely into the gap where it is cheaper to keep paying than to think about not paying. That's a moat that will persist, not because of the ability to charge a lot, but because the cost of the product is so low that customers have no economic reason to leave. It is the same mechanism that lets a toll road increase the toll a nickel a year forever. The toll is trivial next to the cost of taking the long way around. I think Adobe stock is going to be one of the best performing investments of the next decade. At $270, Adobe carries a market capitalization of $108 billion against $10.28 billion of FCF and $5.63 billion of net cash on the balance sheet. That is a FCF yield of over 9% on a business growing double digits, a valuation you normally see on a utility, not a 36% margin software franchise. The most powerful way to see the mispricing is to run the discounted cash flow, DCF, in reverse. Instead of guessing Adobe's growth and solving for value, take today's price as given and solve for the growth rate the market is implying. I ran it conservatively, using free cash flow after subtracting all $1.94 billion of stock-based compensation as a real cost, a 10% discount rate, and a 3% terminal rate. At $270, the market is pricing Adobe to grow FCF at negative 1.2% a year for the next decade. The market is not pricing slower growth. It is pricing a decade of decline for a company whose ARR is accelerating, whose margins are at record highs, and whose backlog is at an all-time peak. Run the DCF forward, on the same conservative cash flow, adjusted for stock-based compensation. Even the bear case, half of Adobe's actual recent growth rate, produces a fair value of $347, 29% above today's price. The base case is $418, roughly 55% upside. And these use cash flow that already deducts every dollar of stock comp, so no one can accuse the model of hiding dilution behind non-GAAP optics. My fair value estimate, weighting the base case and haircutting for genuine AI uncertainty, is in the $380 to $420 range. Against a $270 price, that is a margin of safety wide enough to be wrong about the details and still make money. Adobe's financial picture is clear on earnings. The setup is unusually clear because so much revenue is already contracted. Management has guided to total ARR growth of over 10% in fiscal 2026 and has explicitly said it is targeting acceleration beyond that. Fiscal 2025 non-GAAP earnings were $20.94 per share, up 14% YoY. Wall Street's own consensus has GAAP EPS climbing from $26.56 in fiscal 2026 to $36.32 by fiscal 2028, and note that consensus GAAP earnings now exceed the current non-GAAP figure, because the stock comp gap that inflated non-GAAP numbers a decade ago has largely closed. The quality of earnings is improving, not deteriorating. Layer the buyback on top. Adobe repurchased $11.28 billion of stock in fiscal 2025, a buyback yield of 8.3%, while the price was depressed. When a company earning 36% on capital buys back 8% of its shares a year at 11x earnings, per share value compounds fast. The cheaper the stock stays, the more accretive the buyback becomes. Adobe's own capital allocation is quietly converting the market's pessimism into shareholder returns. The five-year picture, built off the $20.94 fiscal 2025 non-GAAP base, what should investors expect? On a five-year horizon, even the bear case, 8% earnings growth and a permanently depressed 15x multiple, delivers roughly 11% a year. The base case delivers 22% annualized. The reason the outcomes are so favorable is that you are buying growth at no growth prices. You get paid both from the earnings compounding and from the multiple normalizing off a decade low. For context on how far the multiple has fallen, Adobe traded at 52x earnings as recently as fiscal 2023. It trades at 10.1x GAAP trailing earnings today. The market does not need to re-rate Adobe back to 52x for this to work. It merely needs to stop pricing a great business for death. The gap between what the business is doing and what the price says it will do is the widest I have seen in a company of this quality. So, maybe the disruption is real? Nope. The key metric proving the moat. The margins are the tell. If AI were truly hollowing out Adobe's pricing power, you would see it first in the operating margin, because a disrupted franchise has to cut prices and spend to defend share. Instead, the operating margin went from 31.3% in fiscal 2024 to 36.6% in fiscal 2025. rising margins are the hardest thing for a disruption narrative to explain, and Adobe's are rising. I recently conducted a thorough analysis of every publicly traded stock in the United States using the full ShareDar database, roughly 12,000 companies. I wanted to build a list of the 100 best businesses, judged by their actual operating results and ranked by moat. The moat score I built is a composite that rewards businesses that have tollbooth economics, high and stable return on invested capital, low capital intensity, little capex relative to sales, strong FCF conversion, fat gross margins, low leverage, and, critically, stability of those figures over 3 years. Companies with great businesses and incredible moats offer persistent better than market returns on capital. On this metric, out of all companies with at least $1 billion in market cap, Adobe scored number one. The top of the list reads like a who's who of the best business models in the world. Adobe, Visa, V, MasterCard, MA, VeriSign, VRSN, Booking, BKNG, NVIDIA, NVDA, plus the exchange and data oligopolies, Cboe, MSCI, S&P Global, and the design software duopoly, Cadence, Synopsys. These are the payment rails, the registries, the ratings agencies, the mission-critical software, businesses that sit in the middle of an economic flow and clip a fee on every transaction. And, out of all of these amazing businesses, Adobe is number one. It belongs in your portfolio. Action to take. Buy Adobe, NASDAQ, ADB. Up to $600 per share. Review of recommendations. This month's buy recommendations: Domino's Pizza, DPZ, Strong Buy British American Tobacco, BTI, Alphabet, GOOG, Omrise, AMRZ, Uber Technologies, UBER, Skyward Specialty Insurance, SKWD, Credit Acceptance, CACC, Celsius Holdings, CELH, Booz Allen Hamilton, BAH. This month's hold positions: ExxonMobil, XOM, BWX Technologies, BWXT, Core Natural Resources, Corner, Domino's Feels, The Consumer's Pain, Domino's Pizza, NYSE, DPZ, continues to feel the same pressure squeezing the entire fast food industry. 5 years of hot inflation have eroded low-income consumers' purchasing power, and discretionary spending on quick-service food has pulled back industry-wide, showing up in same-store sales, SSS, declines. Domino's has not been immune. Its SSS growth rate has cooled from a prior trajectory of mid-single-digit or even double-digit gains down to the 1% to 3% range in recent years, and Q2 SSS came in flat, with U.S. comps up just 0.1% and international comps turning negative for the first time. But relative to its two largest rivals, Domino's brand strength remains evident. Both Pizza Hut and Papa John's have posted SSS declines in each of the last 3 years, while Domino's has stayed positive, continuing to take market share throughout the industry-wide downturn. In the July 20th Q2 news, overall retail sales still grew 3% year-over-year, YoY, on the back of continued new store openings, a signal that franchisee appetite for expansion remains intact even in a sluggish SSS environment, setting up continued revenue and earnings growth independent of the comp recovery. Revenue rose 4.3% YoY to $1.19 billion, and EPS grew to $4.07 from $3.81 a year earlier, helped by $156.2 million in share repurchases during the quarter and an expanded $1.29 billion buyback authorization. That trajectory keeps the company on track to earn roughly $19 per share in 2026, up about 8% YoY. Action to take. Buy Domino's Pizza, NYSE, DPZ, up to $467.27 per share. British American Tobacco's smoke-free transformation accelerates. British American Tobacco, NYSE, BTI, showed excellent progress on its smoke-free transition when it reported financial results for the first half of 2026 on July 30th. Revenue increased 2.9% YoY. Note, all revenue referenced after adjusting for currency fluctuations, led by an impressive showing in the U.S. where sales grew 8.5% YoY. Earnings per share, EPS, increased 7.9% YoY, with both numbers exceeding analyst estimates. The standout performance came from the company's new category portfolio of less harmful nicotine products, where sales increased 18% YoY. The growth in British Tobacco's less harmful nicotine products is expanding its addressable market, bringing in 4 million new consumers to reach 35 million globally. This marks a major reversal against the prior multi-decade trend of a declining consumer base for traditional tobacco products. In total, the new category segment now makes up 19.8% of total company revenue, up from single digits just 5 years ago. Modern oral products remain the leading performers in the new category portfolio, which includes the hit Velo Plus nicotine pouch brand, sales for the segment increased 65.9% YoY, fueled by the overall growth in the nicotine pouch market along with 8.4 percentage points of global market share gains. In the US, the largest nicotine pouch market globally, Modern Oral sales grew 220% YoY, fueled by 11.9 percentage points of market share gains. This was the crux of our original bull thesis on British Tobacco, and it's playing out faster than expected, with the company's nicotine pouches now commanding 29.8% US market share. British Tobacco management expects this momentum to continue with the launch of its new Velo Max pouches hitting store shelves in the second half of 2026. Meanwhile, another bull catalyst is also beginning to take hold. The crackdown on illegal vape imports, which have taken a big chunk of market share from the legal vape market, including British Tobacco's Vuse sales. State regulators are no longer waiting on the federal government to take action, and they've begun implementing their own crackdowns. This fueled a strong recovery in British Tobacco's Vuse sales in the US, which increased 19.8% YoY. With unauthorized vapes coming off store shelves, Vuse is filling the void, with 4.1 percentage points of market share gains. At the end of June, Vuse commanded a dominant 55.9% share of the US vaping market. With the state-level crackdown on illegal vape imports, Vuse is not only seeing a return to double-digit volume growth, but it's also flexing its pricing power, with 4.9% of Vuse sales growth coming from higher prices in the first half of 2026. We expect these trends to continue now that the competitive pressure from illegal vape imports is waning. Meanwhile, the company's legacy portfolio of combustible tobacco continues churning out reliable growth thanks to robust pricing power, with revenue growth of 2.1% YoY from this segment. Management reiterated its confidence in achieving its 2026 financial targets, which include EPS growth of just over 6% YoY. The company also remains on target to reach its leverage target of less than 2.5x debt to operating income by year-end. This sets the stage for a significant increase in cash returning to shareholders in 2027, through buybacks and dividends. After a decade of flatlining revenue and earnings, British Tobacco, which we recommended in March 2025, is on track toward consistent mid-single-digit revenue and earnings growth. We were puzzled as to why the stock declined by several percentage points despite what we viewed as an excellent earnings report. But with the business valued at just 13x free cash flow, FCF, a nearly 50% discount to its closest peer Philip Morris International, PM, at 25x FCF, we view the shares as deeply discounted. Action to take: buy British American Tobacco, NYSE, BTI, up to $86.54 per share. Big tech turns to debt markets. Again, tech giants' infrastructure arms race has entered a new phase. Equity raises are giving way to an unprecedented wave of corporate borrowing. Industry-wide AI infrastructure spending is projected to exceed $700 billion in 2026, and hyperscalers have collectively issued roughly $194 billion in bonds through July, up 79% from the same period last year. As buyback dollars and even record equity raises prove insufficient to cover the build-out, credit markets have become the new battleground, with credit default swap premiums on major tech issuers climbing to record levels and investor demand for AI-linked debt beginning to soften. Alphabet, Nasdaq, Goog, up nearly 50% since we recommended in September 2025, has been at the center of this shift. On July 22, the company reported Q2 revenue of $119.8 billion, up 24% YoY, with Google Cloud revenue surging 82% to $24.8 billion, but shares fell more than 6% after management raised 2026 CapEx guidance a second time this year, to $195 billion, $205 billion. The spending pushed Alphabet to its first-ever quarter of negative free cash flow since its 2004 IPO. To fund the gap, Alphabet returned to the bond market on August 6 for the third time in 2026, pricing a $25 billion investment-grade offering across 10 tranches that drew roughly $115 billion in orders, bringing total 2026 debt issuance to roughly $70 billion, on top of the $84.75 billion equity raise priced in June. Despite the financing strain, the underlying business continues to scale. Search and other revenue grew 17% YoY. YouTube ads grew 13%, and management reiterated it will keep investing as long as we see an attractive return. Action to take: buy Alphabet, Nasdaq, Goog, up to $345.90 per share. Omrise volumes rise on mega project. Demand oil-driven cost inflation has pushed freight, diesel, and raw material prices sharply higher across the building materials industry this year, compressing margins even at producers with strong order books. At the same time, construction of data centers, power generation, advanced manufacturing plants, and infrastructure continues to drive mega project demand for cement, aggregates, and roofing. OMRI's NYSE, AMRZ, reported Q2 results on August 6 that reflected both. Cement volumes rose 5% and aggregates volumes 6.5%, with aggregates pricing up 4% on a freight-adjusted basis. Revenue increased 8.6% to $3.49 billion, including 6.7% organic growth, and net income rose 14.4% to $476 million, or 86 cents per diluted share. Building envelope revenue grew 9.4%, driven by commercial roofing demand from data centers and warehousing. Cost told the other half of the story. Adjusted EBITDA, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, rose 5.8% to $986 million as higher freight, diesel, and raw material prices reduced the margin by 80 basis points to 28.2%. Management raised full-year revenue guidance to $12.5 billion to $12.7 billion, but lowered EBITDA guidance to a range of $3.1 billion to $3.2 billion from $3.25 billion to $3.34 billion, and raised its tax rate assumption to 23% to 25%. Price increases implemented in April and July are expected to turn price over cost positive in the fourth quarter. Shares have fallen roughly 10% since our December recommendation, including dividends. OMRI's, which we recommended in December, also disclosed a revision to prior period financial statements, principally a $78 million understatement of deferred revenue on extended warranties acquired with Duro-Last and Malarkey, which the company determined was not material to any previously issued financials. The company returned $502 million to shareholders in the quarter, launching its $1 billion repurchase program with $197 million of buybacks and paying the 44-cent special dividend along with the first quarterly dividend of 11 cents. Meanwhile, CEO Jan Jenisch has continued to accumulate shares on the open market, buying another $2.3 million in shares in mid-May at prices above where the stock trades today. Action to take: buy OMRI's, NYSE, AMRZ, up to $73.80 per share. Uber dips on guidance but expands offerings. Shares of ride-sharing leader Uber Technologies, NYSE, Uber, sold off after the company's August 5 earnings report due to a slight miss on Q3 bookings guidance that came in $80 million light of the $59.33 billion consensus, a 0.1% shortfall. But bookings were strong in Q2, and the underlying business is accelerating. Shares have risen to roughly $76 per share, jumping off the 52-week lows post-earnings around $66 per share. Q2 extended Uber's booking streak. Gross bookings grew 22% YoY to more than $58 billion, the fourth consecutive quarter above 20%. Adjusted EBITDA climbed 33% to $2.81 billion, and trailing 12-month FCF crossed $10 billion for the first time in company history. We continue to like Uber as the future aggregator of autonomous vehicles. As CEO Derek Khosrowshahi laid out in a recent interview, a robotaxi fleet on its own might fill 70% of its capacity, but plugged into Uber's marketplace of 208 million monthly users, utilization moves much closer to 100%. For an asset-heavy fleet, that gap is the difference between a science project and a business. The autonomous vehicle, AV, makers need Uber's demand more than Uber needs any single AV maker. Here's why a single fleet, Tesla's robotaxis and Alphabet's Waymos, can't solve this alone. Rideshare demand is brutally spiky. A typical Monday in Austin runs at roughly 45% of a Saturday, and overnight lows hit just 5% of the weekly peak. So every standalone fleet faces an impossible sizing decision. Build for Saturday night, and most of that capital sits idle all week. Build for Tuesday morning, and the fleet fails every peak, exactly when riders decide whether your app can be trusted. On Uber's network, the fleet doesn't have to choose. AVs run the baseload, where they stay nearly fully utilized at the lowest cost per trip, and human drivers absorb the peaks, logging on when surge makes it worth their time. The dark band along the bottom is AV supply running steadily all week. The light band above it is human drivers flexing to meet each day's spikes. An AV-only competitor must either hold significant underutilized supply or leave demand on the table. That's why every AV fleet that enters the market faces the same choice: join the network that keeps it busy, or burn capital fighting the demand curve alone. In markets where robotaxis are widely available outside Uber, Phoenix, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, Uber's trip growth actually increased versus Q1. And the build-out is moving fast. Live in 7 AV cities today, 15 by year-end, with a $10 billion investment program across neuro, Lucid, Zoox, Wave, Baidu, and Pony, where every $1 of Uber capital has drawn $2.50 from outside investors, and this positions Uber to offer more ancillary services that make people's lives easier. Case in point, on Wednesday, Bloomberg reported that code in Uber's latest app reveals a tween rides option in development for kids aged 10 to 12, complete with trusted adult contacts and required grown-up handoffs at pickup. Uber's teen accounts, ages 13 to 17, launched in 2023 and have already scaled to more than 50 countries and tens of millions of trips. The direction is obvious. The school run and the carpool become marketplace demand, and eventually, autonomous supply. From there, it's booking the hotel and restaurant reservation alongside your next trip. Each new category draws more demand, which attracts more supply. Whatever the stock, which we recommended in January 2025, does between now and the company's next report, the setup hasn't changed. This is the marketplace that everyone else's capacity, human or autonomous, needs to run at full economics. Action to take. Buy Uber Technologies, NYSE. Uber, up to $100.38 per share. Uber gives Skyward a boost. When Uber stood up its autonomous solutions unit, it named Apollo, the Lloyd's of London specialty platform that Skyward Specialty Insurance, NASDAQ, SKWD, acquired in January, as the sole insurance carrier for its AV partners. Every Nuro, Zoox, Wave, and Pony.i vehicle that deploys through Uber's marketplace potentially flows through Apollo's insurance book. When we flagged the partnership in March, autonomous rides were 0.1% of trips. 5 months later, they're approaching 0.5% of Uber's 300 million weekly trips, and the live city count is set to double by year-end. Better still, Skyward's own capital backs just 25% of the Lloyd's syndicate writing this business. Third-party reinsurers carry the rest, while Skyward collects fees on the entire book. Uber built the marketplace that every robo-taxi fleet needs to run at full economics. Skyward owns the insurance counter inside it. Action to take. Buy Skyward Specialty Insurance, NASDAQ, SKWD, up to $72.31 per share. Credit acceptance stays on course as volume returns subprime auto lender credit acceptance. NASDAQ, CAC, has given back a chunk of its spring rally. Shares fell 13% in the month leading into its August 4th earnings report as the market digested a wave of leadership transitions, including the retirement of longtime CFO Jay Martin. The Q2 numbers were reaffirming. Adjusted EPS of $12.40 in Q1 was followed by $12.12 in Q2, up 21% YoY, capping a strong first half. And management continued buying back stock, 262,963 shares repurchased in Q2 alone, 2.5% of the share count in a single quarter, bringing the diluted count down nearly 9% over the past year. Forecasted net cash flow revisions came in at negative 0.3%, $39.1 million, a step back from Q1's near-zero number of negative 0.1%, $9.1 million. But what matters is that revision is still half the size of last year's quarter. The modest 2025 vintage underperformance mainly offset outperformance from Q1, and the recent cohorts remain well calibrated. The 2025 vintage sits within 10 basis points of its initial forecast, and the 2026 vintage is collecting at 67.1% against a 67.2% initial forecast. After 3 years of chronic negative revisions, the underwriting model is priced to reality. The payoff is now showing up in originations. Monthly unit volume returned to YoY growth in June, July surged 28%, back to 2024 levels, and the dealer network hit a record 11,004 active dealers for the second consecutive quarter. And the model should only get better from here. New CEO Vinayak Hegde is rebuilding credit acceptance into what he calls a deeply data-informed, AI-enabled company, and already beginning to impact both sides of the business. On Thursday, the company bolstered that strategy by naming Jeetu Merchandani, a 21-year Amazon veteran who served as head of applied AI, as its new CTO effective August 27. Credit acceptance's underwriting model has finally been calibrated to the post-stimulus consumer, and AI is making that model more precise while driving down the cost to run it. For a lender whose entire edge is pricing risk better than competitors, those two forces compounding should be stronger than the stock's recent pullback suggests. Action to take. Buy Credit Acceptance, NASDAQ, CAC, up to $815.66 per share. Celsius. Disappointing Q2 results create buying opportunity. Celsius Holdings. NASDAQ sell, delivered disappointing Q2 results on August 6th, with revenue of $818 million coming in $52 million below the consensus analyst forecasts. Meanwhile, earnings per share, EPS of 36 cents also disappointed relative to the 42 cents consensus estimate for the quarter. The big concern came from unexpected weakness in sales of the company's flagship Celsius brand, where revenues declined 12% YoY, as well as a 13% drop in Rockstar sales. On the positive side, these declines were offset by a 21% YoY increase in Alani Nu sales, leading to overall revenue growth of 10.6% versus the prior year. The declines in Celsius and Rockstar jarred investors, sending the shares plunging by as much as 20% on the news. While the poor performance in these two brands is a concern, we believe the headline numbers overstated the scope of the sales declines, leading to a significant overreaction in the company's share price. Despite the sluggish numbers for Celsius and Rockstar, we did see some bright spots in the report. This included progress in the international expansion of the Celsius brand, where sales increased 10% to $27 million in Q2. Management reiterated its target of achieving more than 15% of total revenue outside of the U.S. within 5 years, with Alani Nu slated to reach new international markets in 2027. The biggest bright spot remains the ongoing success of Alani Nu, which has turned into a powerhouse brand. Despite only registering 21% overall revenue growth in Q2, Alani Nu sales increased by an impressive 55.7% at retail. And for the first half of 2026, the brand generated over $1 billion in retail sales, ending June with an 8.7% share of the total U.S. energy drink category. And that brings us to the bull thesis for Celsius going forward. We believe the shares are too cheap based purely on the value of Alani Nu alone. In the energy drink world, the top brands typically trade at a 10x or higher sales multiple. That was the case for Celsius when it first crossed over the $1 billion mark in annual sales in 2023, at which time it commanded a $12 billion enterprise value. And today, the industry leader Monster Beverage, MNST, generates $9 billion in annual sales and trades at a $90 billion enterprise value. It's also worth noting that Monster's 10x sales multiple is for a business growing at 10% per year, the same growth rate Celsius posted in Q2. With Alani Nu now generating $2 billion in annualized sales, we believe this brand alone is worth $20 billion. But for the sake of conservatism, we'll assign a 50% discount to the typical 10x sales multiple and estimate a fair value of $10 billion. Now consider that, at a recent price of $28 per share, the entire Celsius business that includes the Alani Nu, Rockstar, and Celsius brands trades for an enterprise value of just $9 billion. In other words, Celsius currently trades at a 10% discount to what we believe is a conservative estimate of the value of Alani Nu alone. We're not the only one seeing this valuation disconnect. On August 7th, the day following Celsius's disappointing Q2 earnings report, news broke that Russ Savage acquired a 4.7% stake in the business worth $300 million. Savage is a veteran of the energy drink world, having previously founded the Rockstar Energy brand that Pepsi acquired for $4 billion in 2020, which was then sold to Celsius last year. In comments to CNBC, Savage noted that he has been in talks with Celsius management about improving the business for over a year. But now, he's taking a more aggressive and public approach, noting to CNBC that the CEO, the COO, the brand manager, and the marketing manager all need to be fired. Savage also commented that he would like to take over as CEO of Celsius to fix the problems he sees at the company. While it's too early to tell how this drama unfolds, one thing we can say for sure is that we see significant value among all three Celsius brands that's not currently reflected in the market price of the business. Thus, we continue recommending shares of Celsius, and for investors who don't yet have a position, we suggest taking advantage of the recent share price weakness as a buying opportunity. Action to take: buy Celsius Holdings, NASDAQ, sell, up to $31.06 per share. Booz Allen offsets revenue declines with cost-cutting. Government contractor Booz Allen Hamilton, NYSE, BAH, reported solid fiscal Q1 2027 earnings on July 24. Despite revenue growth that fell 4.2% YoY, the company's cost-cutting efforts reduced expenses enough to send adjusted net income higher by 17.9% YoY. Meanwhile, the company continues taking advantage of its depressed share price with an aggressive pace of share buybacks, fueling an even larger 22.3% YoY increase in earnings per share to $1.81 for the quarter, handily exceeding analyst estimates of $1.49. The company's FCF came in strong at $261 million, up 172% from $96 million in the prior year quarter. The main factor weighing on Booz Allen's revenue growth remains the ongoing weakness in its civil segment, where sales declined 16% YoY. Management noted that the civil business will likely post another sequential decline in fiscal Q2 before stabilizing, as prior year contract reductions and weak discretionary federal spending remain a drag for this segment. On the positive side, the company's national security segment, which now includes revenue from defense and intelligence customers, which were previously reported separately, increased 1% YoY. This segment now makes up 72% of total revenue, and will provide the engine of growth going forward. With no shortage of global conflicts and an ever-rising budget for U.S. national defense, management expects this segment to lead the inflection point in the company's growth rate going forward. We can see the early signs of a turning point in the business based on an improving book-to-bill ratio, which measures the amount of new contracts awarded relative to the revenue recognized in a given period. Anything above 1.0x means the future pipeline of new business is growing faster than current revenue. In its fiscal Q1 report, the company reported a 1.5x book-to-bill ratio, up significantly from 1.1x over the last 12 months. With this improving order book, management expects revenue growth to recover from the prior trend of mid-single-digit declines toward 0% to 4% growth for fiscal 2027. Meanwhile, the company's cost-cutting measures have kept earnings growth humming along at an impressive rate despite the weakness in top-line revenue. Remember that as a consultant, Booz Allen can quickly react to slowing business by paring back its headcount. The company has cut its workforce 7% YoY, which is pushing down operating costs by a wider margin than the current pace of revenue declines. That's how the company delivered 8% growth in operating income despite the 4% sales decline. Looking ahead, management noted it's planning to begin rehiring workers in response to recovering demand in its national security segment, which provides another positive indicator of renewed growth ahead. For fiscal 2027, management expects the business to generate EPS of $6.17. At a recent stock price of $78, the business trades at just 12x earnings, a compelling value for a business of Booz Allen's quality. With the worst of the revenue declines likely in the rearview, we see minimal downside risk and outsized return potential from here. Action to take: buy Booz Allen Hamilton, NYSE, BAHEC, up to $197.51 per share. Hold positions ExxonMobil posts record results. As shares recover on July 31, ExxonMobil, NYSE, XUM, reported the largest quarterly profit in company history, $14.5 billion, or $3.48 per share, against $4.2 billion in Q2. It did that while roughly 10% of its upstream production sat shut in, with 400,000 barrels of oil equivalent per day, BOE/D, offline in Qatar and the United Arab Emirates. Excluding those volumes, production was the highest in more than two decades. Permian production set a record above 1.8 million BOE/D, tracking management's planned 9% annual growth rate through 2030. Gross production in Guyana reached roughly 900,000 barrels per day, and the fifth floating production vessel, Area Widow, set sail during the quarter for a Q4 startup that adds another 250,000 barrels per day of capacity. Exxon is now also evaluating a ninth Stabroek project. FCF was $17.2 billion for the quarter. The company returned $9.4 billion to shareholders, retired more than $7 billion of net debt, and declared a Q3 dividend of $1.03 per share payable September 10. Unfortunately, the share price has been far more volatile than the underlying business. Shares, which we recommended in February, surged along with the broad energy sector into late March on the war premium in crude. Brent touched $126 after Iran closed the Strait of Hormuz, and then gave nearly all of it back as the strait began reopening and Brent fell to $74 by late June. Exxon fell more than 21% from its March high to its June 29 bottom, roughly in line with the sector. Since then, the shares have recovered nearly 20% and currently trade within 8% of the March peak. Action to take: hold shares of ExxonMobil, NYSE. ZEM Nuclear Momentum continues at BWX Technologies, commercial nuclear power provider BWX Technologies. NYSE, BWXT, extended its growth run into Q2, reporting revenue of $902 million, up 18% YoY, alongside adjusted EPS of $1.07, up 5% YoY. Backlog climbed to $8.4 billion, up 40% YoY, with a trailing 12-month book-to-bill ratio of 1.7x, underscoring continued strong order intake across both segments. Management raised full-year FCF guidance to a range of $345 million to $360 million, and lifted 2026 adjusted EBITDA guidance to a range of $662 million to $672 million, while narrowing EPS guidance to a range of $4.70 to $4.80. The quarter also brought portfolio moves that sharpened BWX Technologies' focus. On July 1, the company closed its previously announced acquisition of Precision Components Group, expanding its U.S. manufacturing footprint for commercial nuclear components. Alongside earnings, management announced a definitive agreement to sell its medical business to Nordic Capital for up to $800 million, while retaining a minority stake, a step that concentrates the company more fully on its core nuclear national security and commercial power markets. Commercial operations revenue rose 72% YoY, but adjusted EBITDA growth of just 7% lagged the 18% top-line gain, reflecting margin pressure from capacity investment in the U.S. and Canada. The stock, up 200% since we recommended it, has pulled back roughly 5% over the past month, and now trades around 25% below its April all-time high near $242, even as the underlying growth story, bolstered by the Navy's accelerated four-year Ford-class ordering cadence and active new build talks with GE Vernova and Westinghouse, remains intact. Action to take. Hold shares of BWX Technologies, NYSE, BWXT, Core Natural Resources lifts, volumes and cuts costs. Coal markets remained soft through the second quarter. Moderate temperatures, low natural gas prices, and elevated customer stockpiles pressured domestic thermal demand, while seaborne metallurgical markets stayed muted following 2 years of contraction in global hot metal output. U.S. East Coast coking coal assessments continue to trail Australian indices by a historically wide margin. Core Natural Resources, NYSE, Corner, improved its own position regardless. In its August 6th report, the company posted Q2 net income of $126.5 million, or $2.51 per diluted share, against $21.0 million and 41 cents in the first quarter. Adjusted EBITDA rose to $323.6 million from $179.9 million on revenues of $1.1 billion, and FCF reached $148.0 million. Volumes and costs both moved in the right direction. High calorific value thermal sales rose 9% sequentially to 8.4 million tons as cash costs fell 9% to $38.58 per ton, lifting segment-adjusted EBITDA to $165 million from $126 million. Metallurgical coking sales rose 8% to 2.3 million tons with cash costs down 7% to $85.65 per ton. The core marine terminal shipped 5.2 million tons versus 4.8 million in the first quarter. Realized pricing was flat to slightly lower across all three segments, so the margin gains came from execution rather than coal prices. Powder River Basin volumes of 10.2 million tons reflected seasonally weak spring shipments, with more than 50 million tons committed for 2026 delivery and pit inventory built to support the second half. Core also settled its Leer South insurance claim for the full limit, recognizing the remaining $125.4 million in the quarter, a one-time item that will not repeat. Capital returns remain the strongest element. Core has now repurchased 4.3 million shares, roughly 8% of the float when the program launched in February 2025, at an average price of $77.04, a nearly 20% discount to today's price. The company returned $68 million in the quarter, holds $670.8 million of remaining authorization, and declared a 10-cent quarterly dividend payable September 18. After a difficult stretch, the operational improvement here looks real. However, we'd like to see it continue for an additional quarter or two before considering adding to the position. For now, we are moving this recommendation to hold. Action to take. Hold shares of Core Natural Resources, NYSE, Corner. Check out the full list of recommendations here. Porter & Company. Stevenson, Maryland. For important disclosures and disclaimers, please visit our legal disclosures page. Thank you for being a paid subscriber to Porter & Company. We hoped you enjoyed this audio issue. In addition to this issue, you should check out our top three best buys where we highlight three current portfolio picks that are at an attractive buy point today. You can find the top three best buys under the Best Buys link on our site at porterandcompanyresearch.com.